this contact of undergraduate students with graduate students could be as useful as the contact with the...
My undergraduate...
Good professors.
I don't know how you work, but my technique was whenever I found a bright student, I'd put him on a project. I think we've got to learn in this country to capture our brightest people, brightest youngsters, and put them to work in things where they feel that they are beginning to make a contribution.
There you go.
If we do enough of that, they aren't going to want to tear the damn system down.
They do that.
Our rules, if, you know, I don't have tenure in this job. And before the limit of my term of office comes, I hope to have made an impact on that particular aspect. I think that it's the number one priority problem for educators in America. And there are lots of techniques. All that it requires is the faculty, which is smart enough, heaven knows, and creative enough, heaven knows, take it unto itself as a high priority task. And if it does, we'll get solved. If it doesn't, we won't.
It's delightful to hear you talking this way. You're getting right at the gut problems that are in all universities today. I mean, just the main line of interdisciplinary problems.
Well,
this is the most difficult thing to overcome. And really, about the only place that it is ever overcome, and it's not with any university at present, though I think it could be, is in the, you mentioned, think tanks. Well, it's there where you bring together, in close physical proximity, your economists and your lawyers and your physicists and your chemists. The RAND type, the Institute of Defense Analysis, or this kind of thing.
Just the ones that you're trying to tear down.
You have specialists, that's right, but you've got, well, that's another line, but anyway, you've got specialists in their own field, just because they are in literally physical proximity with neighbors, a certain amount of it rubs off. What you were saying a moment ago, you're picking up some law knowledge from someone, you're picking up some economics from someone else. The great interdisciplinary labs of the world have all operated this way, people in close proximity. I've often thought we ought to completely mix up this campus, and I really don't think it will ever work any other way at any university until you take half the economics department and put them with half the physics department, this kind of thing. Now, this is what one would have to do if one wanted to follow the pattern of all the successful interdisciplinary labs. But now you're really striking at the very root core of the department system of the university.
Well, I don't mind that at all.
I don't either, but
I
agree with us.
10 years ago, I resigned from the University of California over this issue. I went to Dartmouth and set up a program. I'm very pleased with it because it was highly interdisciplinary, still is, even though I've been gone a year. I have students working in Jersey City, teaching in the high school. These are engineering undergraduate students teaching science courses in the high school in Jersey City in collaboration with engineering students from Tuskegee Institute. We have sponsored a course called College Course Number 1. Now, the reason that it has that name is that in the 200-year history of Dartmouth College, it's the first time a course was developed which was not social sciences or humanities or sciences. It's a course called the Determination of Public Policy. And each year, the course, which is open to anyone in the college above, I guess, the junior year, takes up the task of writing public policy on an issue, such as what should be the policy for the control of the Connecticut River. And if I were here, I would propose what should be public policy with respect to the exploitation of the oil fields in the north. And the students are challenged to write a public law. And in trying to do this, they have hearings and they invite people from outside and they sit down and try to resolve these issues. And humility comes out of this. Realization.
Frustration.
Doesn't have to be frustration. What came out of the pollution problem, the students wanted to form a private company and go into the business because a math major and a sociologist and engineer wanted to start a company. Because after 10 weeks of intensive study and comparing what they had done with what the politicians in Vermont and New Hampshire and Connecticut, what had come out of them, the students figured they were already competitive. This involved such things as the time-shared computer being used to simulate stream flows so they could test public policy. This involved a whole host of things. But most of all, it brought people together in a responsible way. And I think the opportunities for this at universities are enormous, and the only barrier is the faculty.
Agreed. You know, you mentioned this business of students wanting to tear down the think tank kind of thing. I think that...
Well, I think someone else did, but...
doesn't matter who. I think that part of the problem there is that they don't realize what goes on.
No, in fact,
if you got them inside of it before it received a bad reputation, that they would already take
to. Oh, the problem just lies in the fact that places like Rand, of course, didn't build their reputations on military research. Application of operations research, etc., to military problems. But now, if you look at the Rand, whatever it calls itself, constitution, or anyway, set of what it's working on, there are 6 points. I can't read them off offhand, but they include things like urban planning and... Well, many of the sort of things we've been talking about this morning. Clearly, the think tank concept can be where you bring together a group of interdisciplinary people can be applied to anything, including the reorganization of a university, I might add. Very profitably, I would say. I'd love to see what Rand would do with that.
Those groups are probably...
I wish you'd just
said
organizations.
So those things are problem-oriented, in a sense, rather than discipline-oriented.
Yes.
And they don't necessarily destroy the disciplines or the value of the disciplines themselves, but they do bring them together.
But from being isolated
in compartments...
You've got to have a man present in the group who knows, well, the kind of thing we're talking about today, knows the E&M. I think a lot of people confuse what we're talking about with trying to train from about first-year level the generalist who really ends up having a smattering of everything, but does not know the Maxwell equations. Does not know the theories of economics.
That's equally bad. There's a possibility of...
I think many students are seeing it this way, though. It starts from the beginning and learn a bit of everything.
That's all right. I was interrupting you, I'm sorry. There's a possibility that we can get carried away by our own enthusiasm for this wisdom that we've all discovered last decade. Because certainly 10 years ago, if we had talked this way, we would have not found many supporters, and we wouldn't have been all that sure that we were right. Unfortunately, in most universities, it's a zero-sum game. Unless the university is in a rapidly expanding era, there are budgetary and space and personnel limitations, and the growth of a program means some other program somewhere is not growing as rapidly. And everyone knows this, and the disciplines are all well entrenched, and no matter how you say it, if you develop a program which is interdisciplinary, some positions just don't get filled within disciplines, and everybody knows this. And I think it's therefore very important to make the participants in this game see what really is at stake. I had at Dartmouth at the engineering school to develop 2 programs. One was leading to the Doctor of Engineering degree, and the other leading to the PhD in engineering, for example. And it was necessary for me to draw very carefully for the faculty, to draw the picture for them so they could see the relationship they had one to the other. What's the word for it? Symbiotic relationship. Like the birds that feed on the insects and the rhinoceros' hide, that each needs the other, and that there's a balance that makes them healthier. Nothing gives more impetus to a discipline than the discovery that in applications, it turns out that important applications are held up because the frontiers of the discipline haven't been pushed back far enough. And this happens over and over again. And if you're going to develop interdisciplinary programs, I think it's terribly important to make those who are in the disciplines understand this, because in general they don't. We've gone long enough now under the pressure of strengthening the disciplines that the associate professor levels and some of the full professors now are staffed by people who have no real experience outside their discipline and don't understand how the discipline fits. And the way you can get the answer to that is very easy. You go to the graduate students in a department and you say, now that you've finished your thesis, What criteria do you use for deciding what you will work on next? And the answers you get back show that they have been totally disconnected from anything.
We just approved about a month ago, when I was chairman of the committee that looked into it, an interdisciplinary, highly interdisciplinary master's program in regional community development. And this will be housed in the Department of Geography, but we will have an admissions committee, really assigning ad hoc admissions committees to each student who wants to do this in this area, this area, this area, or these areas. Mm-hmm. And this is just going to get off the ground this fall. It's so generally put together that it would lend itself very nicely, I think, to what you've been talking about here, because it also offers a variety of degrees, mm-hmm. the MA, the MS, and others, if we wish to just say a master's in this and this.
Mm-hmm. Have you set up criteria for the degrees? Let me put it another way. Have you set up a specification or a description of the qualities and attributes you want the students to have when they emerge from the program?
Dr. Rashi is doing this right now.
There is a tendency in budgeting, either in the federal government or in the university, to be very scrupulous about the input and not have very good measures on the output. So that courses are so that degrees are described in terms of the courses the student took, rather than in terms of the attributes he has, or a program in the federal government is described in terms of the funding that went into it and not the productivity that came out of it.
Well, the reason we kept this general, but we'll be more specific about what one must do to get a particular degree or an interdisciplinary degree that might have.
No, but when you say, let me press you, he set the pace for asking questions that are beyond shallow level. Let me press you here. When you talk about describing the degree, now are you describing the degree in terms of the courses the student takes, or are you going to describe the degree in terms of what the student is able to do and let him take whatever courses he wants?
Of the objective rather than some of the courses aren't even spelled.
No, objective isn't the same as performance criteria. Let me give you an example of what I mean, because maybe I'm not maybe there's an ambiguity in my remark. We said that a student who is going to get a degree, Bachelor of Engineering, must have shown the ability to recognize a human need, transform it into a statement representing something an engineer can contribute to, develop criteria for showing that he had indeed achieved his objective. He must have the ability to make an economic analysis. He must have the ability to plan his work and that of others required to do the task. He must have the ability to go into the laboratory, plan an experiment, and carry it out. He must have the ability, with pencil and paper, to predict the outcome of a physical experiment. Now, if he can do all those things, he gets his degree. He can take any damn thing he wants. But those are specific attributes, and you have a checkoff list and says, yes, the student did this experiment, which he designed himself, and here is, somebody signed it off, said it was a good job. And in his project, he demonstrated his ability to define a human need by doing so-and-so. He made a market study, and he came up with the fact that people wanted this kind of a thing, and therefore he set about designing one. Now that's what I mean by output measure.
Well, you know,
is that what you're talking about?
I've just made a note.
That might end up in the catalog one day.
Well,
it is in the catalog. In the Fair School of Dartmouth College.
I'm sure it is, and you wrote it.
Copyright.
Yes, sir. You wrote it. No, we haven't gotten that specific yet, because we approved this about a month ago. Now that we've approved the concept, we've turned over to geography to keep, and it will keep it very interdisciplinary. And Dr. Rash is working on this precisely right now.
What?
I think that we can feed him your 7 points or 8 points, whatever they were.
What you're really talking about is something that the educational community, meaning the educational theorists, have been coming around to in recent years, which are, they call them objectives, but they call them objectives stated in behavioral terms.
Mm-hmm.
End product, measurable behavioral objectives.
Yes.
Come in.
Professor Lafferty, I would like to meet Dr. Travis, so may I, sir?
Dr. Lafferty, why don't you just stay here and turn it
on? I will for a minute and listen to what
Dr. Hayden.
This is Mr. Walter Muller, who's with Dr. Travis' party, and I will save the introduction until...
Have this chair right here.
No, sit down. Well, I think this can be...
Sit down.
Come on, here. Let's read. This approach to the design of the educational experience has a number of enormous implications. For example, you begin to be concerned not only with the content of courses, but the style in which courses are taught and the perception the student has of his role in society as he progresses through this. That leads you to re-examine the nature of the assignments. For example, we re-examined the courses of instruction and raised the question, how many experiences of a creative nature does the student have, and how many experiences of a purely analytic nature? For example, instead of answering a question, maybe he should be asked to formulate what the question ought to be. Instead of doing an experiment someone has set for him, maybe he should decide whether an experiment is needed, and if so, what character. And by going back through the curriculum and examining in detail what the students were doing, we found it necessary to revise some of their experiences. Otherwise, there was no chance that they could have these attributes at the end. This, in turn, changes the whole character of the Committee on Courses of Instruction. What you expect of it. And by this kind of institutional change, I mean, this change in what it is how you describe success, that change propagates a whole series of shock waves through a faculty of an institution.
It's frightening how well our students have been conditioned to the point that it doesn't occur to them that they have any right to be thinking about what questions ought to be asked. Some of them are very, very well plugged into the system the way it's been operating.
Yes, you're talking about the vast majority. That means that they won't ask questions when they're led by anybody. They want to have it. It's not their image. They just have to fit into the scheme. If the new scheme is to burn down the university, then they just want to find out how to strike the matches.
That's the old mold psychology.
Well, I wonder if we're at a point where we might go around the table briefly and perhaps trot out for your inspection some of the things that intrigue us at the moment that I think probably have some commonalities with what it is that Dr. Hayden's study is attempting to do and so on. And
I'll be with the governor, maybe I can put a good word in there. He's got an important resource up here that he's not using.
Well, you know the story about the prophet in his own country. I think that perhaps we could kick it off by talking about something I'm sure you're aware of, and while it has a peripheral connection with the study that Dr. Hayden's conducting, and that is the proposed satellite demonstration for Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
The only hard, concrete progress that has been made in that demonstration has taken place on this campus in the past month. Professor Merritt in the Department of Electrical Engineering succeeded in establishing an earth terminal for the audio portion of the experiment, and has successfully communicated with ATS-1 and with stations in the lower 48. From the programming and production standpoint, the university's radio operation has produced programming in that area. And my commission has been working with the community of Bethel in southwest Alaska, which is a rural, one of the bush communities that we're concerned with. And we will be establishing there an AM educational radio station to serve about a 200-mile radius in that area. And we anticipate an interconnection between the university and Bethel via ATS-1 on a demonstration basis. The audio part's easy because it's relatively inexpensive.
What about the content?
The technology is off the shelf and so on. There are lots of problems in terms of content.
Yes, sir. It's the old software-hardware problem.
That's right.
Sure. We've never produced any SMS.
Now,
very little.
What happened, Ed, to our the inquiry we made of the program in Australia? You're aware of the
program? Oh, yes.
Do you have all of their materials? You know all about it?
They know more about it than we do, Myron.
I see.
Now, they have a very, very exciting program. They have some things there that we do not have to face. We are in the position of having teachers in every remote location, maybe only one or two for 8 grades of instruction, but there are teachers present, which is not the case.
I went for 5 years to one room schoolhouse with 17 other kids and one teacher. Greatest education I ever got.
That's the only education you ever got at that time.
Yes.
It's hard, you can't hardly compare it to anything else.
I understand what happened when I came into the big school and the habits I had vis-a-vis the others. That's what I meant.
That's why I appreciated going in the school in eastern Montana, same reason.
Well, anyway, there
subject matter I didn't do as well.
There are problems that we need to face, not only with audio, but with video into these rural villages. That technology aside, if we may do that for a moment, there are problems that have to be faced in this area of what ought the content to be and how it ought to be received and so on. But you can't really say technology aside, because the technology has a very important impact on not only the content, but the means of its distribution and so on. So we're interested in pursuing the audio, the video as well, and I think maybe Bob would want to speak to the point of what are yet some of the unanswered questions, even technically, in these latitudes. Give a whirl at that.
Well, we're proposing to investigate the effect the aurora would have, certainly, in magnetic disturbances, ionospheric storms,
on
the transmission to and from the satellite. Uh-huh. We've transmitted to the ATS-1, received here and received in Mojave and Stanford and Wisconsin and even NIH at Bethesda, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And we have signal to noise of 43 dB reported on our hour-long educational program experiment, and our reception here is a little bit limited by our noisy campus, but if we had receiver site, we'd have had a similar signal noise. We would be interested in investigating the effect the aurora would have on these signal conditions. We anticipate fades of perhaps 20 dB during high ionospheric activity. And this would not interfere with the communications circuit, but it would reduce the broadcast quality.
What band, what, is this voice grade?
This is voice, yeah.
This is voice grade?
Yes. We were able to pick up equipment that was not in use on the voice program. There's very few TV transmitters receiver systems that aren't.
No, I was just trying to get an idea whether you were using a wider band capable of transmitting music or whether you were limiting.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. We were transmitting voice music as by voice.
More like a broadcast band.
Yes.
Like a broadcast band.
Yeah, of course, you see.
Kilocycles, not megacycles.
That's true, yes.
Well, one of the things that the ATS-1 experiment is doing is it's taking a capability that was designed in the satellite for something entirely different.
I understand. I'm just trying to get it. So that you have the capability here of tying in time-shared computing and things like that, too.
Yes, we've discussed this and measured the bandwidth and capability and signal noise in terms of
you can get better reliability.
Yes.
Now, when you talk about signal noise, you could have on the average, but you might have times in there, a few milliseconds or so, where it wasn't that good, and this would just raise hell with digital transmission. Would you tell me what it is?
Well, our transmissions have been limited to several hours, during which times we've had no activity.
Mm-hmm. But when you have activity,
due to the fact that our permission to transmit occurred simultaneously with quiet ionosphere. This is something which is not
by accident.
This is not by our choice. This is by arrangement with NASA and the ionosphere. I don't know how this works out. what we'd like to get is more time on the air to where we can anticipate some fading and so forth. We do have continuous recordings made at the Institute of Illinois site of ATS telemetry channel, which shows a phase of up to 15-20 dB. Mm-hmm. But we've not experienced any of this on our transmissions. Our signals have been very solid, very steady, and so good that we're a little nervous about it.
not only that, but you see, obviously, what you're getting at is the same thing, that if this were cranked into some sort of an operating program, before we do that, we've got to find out what the subjective qualitative evaluation of this thing is. Let's say in Bethel, Alaska, if we're going to try to do something with it that's more than what engineers would call communications quality.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to the content?
We raised ourselves some questions about whether the state of Alaska had the resources to back up the software development required, because I once was on a television show. I had a television show for CBS. And it's a fantastic monster to chew up material. To keep that boob tube going takes an awful lot of work. And you just look at the budgets for these shows, and you know what's involved. And we in education have not been habituated to that kind of money, or to managing that kind of money, even worse. If you were to start pouring that amount of money in a typical educational operation, the efficiency curve would droop very badly, unless you did it over a long period of time. When you're experimenting, do you have an answer back capability? Teach with answer back?
No, well, you see, at this point,
it's just a broadcast.
All we've done
we've operated in duplex operations, so the answer back would be immediately available. We've operated our equipment in that mode for this purpose, for demonstrating
obviously
this.
Obviously, this would not be available if you were going to a broadcast station and then from the broadcast station out into some community somewhere.
I understand. Yes.
The possibilities exist for doing this sort of thing, although the research so far on answer back capability, even where they've designed it into ETV and audio systems, is not terribly encouraging.
Incidentally, Travis, you're hearing an extension. This thing they're talking about is an extension of some of the ETV demonstration discussions that we have had. It's beyond the concept of the politically conceived operation.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were going around the table, and so
okay.
Who else?
I'm a bit disappointed that our gentleman from the Institute for Economic, Social, and Governmental Research is not with us this morning. He was here yesterday afternoon and spoke of his concern for the communication patterns that exist in the rural village now.
Oh, yeah.
And what they might become with the advent of modern communication technology in those areas, and how what they already know and what they yet need to know will condition whatever it is we do there.
Well, without attention to this, we're on the point of having one culture destroy another. That's one clear-cut conclusion. The other is, I hoped I'm going to speak to the health needs.
That was how you, we got off on a sidetrack there for a moment. I have been to a meeting with the National Institute of Health on the transmission of health
information,
slow scan, TV pictures. We have the capability and are set up to transmit and receive this at the present time. We have also investigated the possibility of transmitting cardiograms, encephalograms, and so forth like this, and also the chance of, with the duplex operation we mentioned, of having the a physician of a specialist conversing mm-hmm. with the physician of the on-site to discuss the patient's needs and requirements. Mm-hmm. We have further attended a meeting in the University of Washington's Medical Center with the NIH representative concerning the possibility of hooking our local hospital through the ATS-1 mm-hmm. satellite with a demonstration of the vital signs from a patient in intensive care here to the intensive care monitoring service at the University mm-hmm. of Washington Medical Center. And we have the arrangements with the engineering department of the University of Washington. They are setting up a transmitter receiver system, and the intensive care people at the medical center, and Mr. Spees, Gary Spees of the local hospital, is very enthusiastic about this. We'd like to demonstrate this capability with the normal intensive care, which is about 4 to 6 channels of communication of data. And we can do it by the ATS-1 satellite. We have the capability of doing that.
I think there's a point on that, too. We have a rather rudimentary means of radio diagnosis now in some of the remote areas of Alaska. The people turn on their radio and radio in the symptoms, and the doctor prescribes, say, from Nome up into those sort of
The doctor isn't seeing the patient now. He's talking to them on the phone.
Just trying to help them by radio, and we've been doing that for quite a while.
Sometimes they have a health nurse who gets assistance
or
from the
teacher.
Doctor, yeah. Or the BIA teacher,
or an airline pilot.
Yeah.
Now, what about the needs for aircraft navigation and the like? Do you rely on the FAA to specify those needs for the state? Yeah. That's it. So the federal government at this point specifies what the state needs as far as transportation goes by air.
Well, carrying what Bob said just a little further before we get off that.
Excuse me, isn't that a wonderful example of why the state has got to have its own telecommunications competence? If you don't, in that whole area.
It's dictated to us.
Dictated to us.
That's right.
And therefore, your options and growth in the future are determined.
That's right.
And it isn't fair for you to say, we're tired of the government dictating this. You know, the reason for that is there's no voice to answer. It's like the telephone line, I'm on one end and nobody on the other end. Well, the guy at the other end isn't talking, and he complains because I use up all the time.
But this is, now we're learning to talk, and we're being heard.
Everything that Bob talks about is with the ATS-1 satellite, which is mm-hmm. an old satellite that shows no great signs of ill health, but we know it's not going to last forever, and it's certainly not an operational satellite. And so we get right back to what this is going to demonstrate in terms of what could be done, and then the determination has to be made, is this a requirement? Is this really a communications requirement for the state of Alaska?
How does something become a requirement for the state of Alaska?
That's a policy matter. And what I'm getting at here is that I think one of the problems that Dr. Hayden is running into in conducting his study is a reluctance, at least in some quarters, to speak to this issue in the public interest, someone who represents the public interest point of view and who says, here are our needs, here are some ways to meet those needs, here are the costs that are involved, here are the trade-offs that are involved, how do we propose to do it? The decision first has to be made whether we do it, and then what are the alternatives in achieving that? And particularly when we get into the area of remote consultation by satellite for doctors, or even the remote delivery of educational material. We're talking about a subsidized situation that is not something that's commercially viable.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
So here we
education never has been, nor has helped.
So we're right back into a policy area, and again, the need for economic input and regulatory input into whatever it is that we do.
I hoped you'd wind up by saying, and this underscores the need for this institutional arrangement. That is, it isn't just that you need to make economic input or educational input. It's that you have to have some place to put it in. At the moment, the state doesn't have an adequate place for that. Until that is resolved, all these other problems aren't going to get resolved.
We're making every particular effort to try to seek out information about state goals rather than for us to try to say what the state's goals should be, to seek out knowledgeable people who are in positions of responsibility who could say what they think the state's goal should be. And it's a bit of a frustrating experience, frankly, because there aren't people who are knowledgeable.
Okay, well, maybe we should proceed around the table. Which one
Excuse
of you
me, is going to make sure? What time are we to be back?
I'll get you out of here in time. We need to cut off in about 15 minutes.
All right.
Who would like to speak for the
Do you want to talk at all about, well, I talked enough this morning, but I think it's Glenn and Tom had a chance to leave, but do you want to say anything about the moves that have been made in connection with the Ford Foundation and this sort of thing, or do you feel that's been covered sufficiently regarding possibilities for future
generations
of satellites? If so, you might,
Tom can
speak. We'd be concerned with the technical side of it. Would you
well,
like?
there's a content component in that too. Well.
Well, all I can say is the exploration I've done in looking into the possibilities of using future generations of satellites, such as the ATSF, for either a system or an experimental system in television broadcasting to Alaska. And there does seem to be a possibility with ATSF, sort of a question mark. Seems as though there may be other more suitable frequencies rather than this high UHF to be used for educational broadcasting. But ATSF does present a technological answer to a low-cost village-type system for educational satellite broadcasting.
Both of the approaches so far have been to look at what's available, what's been offered, and say, well, what can I do with it? What about your developing on your own a statement of, well, this is the job we want to do, and this is what we need to do it, and transmit this to NASA or COMSAT?
Well, Governor Miller has sent, at my request, to NASA, speaking specifically to the ATSG, whose format had not been firmly established, and simply saying that we have a need to provide broadband communication capability, television and other systems, into our remote areas, and we need low-cost, small, unmanned terminal capability on the ground, and not specifying frequency or anything.
That's right. That's specifying the terms of the job to be done.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's precisely along
and,
the lines.
And we also spoke to the idea of semi-direct FM for audio.
This again points, though, to the need for developing your own expertise, your own capability to identify problems, to know what the problem is, and to get it across.
I think there are many areas in which we have some ideas about what the problems are. For instance, what general kind of information. We've talked about health, and certainly we've done a lot of soul searching about the Bethel radio station, mm-hmm. what kind of job it should be playing. But you always find someone who in the back of the room pops up and says, well, that's very nice, but when you start figuring out how much this is going to cost, you idealists will have to, and you know.
There's, there's always somebody who can think of the reasons that a thing can't be done. This is a typical bureaucratic stance. So what's needed is people who will say, that, oh, the reason that it can't be done, let's find out how it can be done.
But her comment about costs are right.
It's not,
but
it's not,
but they're not insoluble.
Germane. Yeah.
Because what we're talking about now is, what a, you see, all the costs for doing anything, including getting ham and eggs for breakfast in Alaska, are large. They're not a cheap price.
Are collaborative?
And well, therefore, before somebody, you know, say, you know, suppose we didn't have public education today. Somebody said, let's put in public education. And you're like, wait, what cost? God, you can't do that. Okay? When a horse was $50, who would have thought you'd spend $2,000 for an automobile? After all, it does get a horse.
I hadn't
thought of that.
But you see, there's a. Yes? You haven't been. You don't have any experience, I do.
Well, these are the kind of people, though, that we have.
Follow what you do, get 10,000 horses in New York City? 10,000.
I'd like to make a comment about a point that Dr. Hayden raised. I think you fringed on the problems that you and your people have encountered in trying to find out who can we talk to in Alaska, what sort of planning operations exist. I'd just like to mention, in case you're not aware, but the suggestion has been made, though certainly not in any way approved and may never be approved, for the formation of a sort of, whatever you call it, Alaska Academy of Sciences, something comparable to the New York Academy of Sciences, something that would in fact serve this kind of objective of bringing together knowledgeable people in many disciplines, so that you would have the possibility of forming a kind of a think tank situation. But more important than that, these people would be knowledgeable enough to know who to go to for other information. Now, this is in the governor's office. Whether he would choose to smile upon it or not is something that I haven't heard about.
That's very interesting.
I think the word sciences should be reconsidered here and make sure that it isn't just physical sciences.
Yes.
Oh,
very definitely. There was no intent to be limited. I mean, certainly across the board in the biological and social sciences, unquestionably, economics, it has been suggested to be extended to include all of the arts and the humanities.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a wide open at the present time still, but I have no idea what the fate of the matter will be. But you ought to know that it has been suggested quite seriously and documented.
That sounds good.
There's a firm proposal. And by the way, I think
Does any embryo organization exist there? Does any embryo of that organization exist besides
all.
A proposal?
No.
Because if it does, I'd like to get in touch with it for a specific.
We could always get you a copy of the original document suggesting it.
How about the AAAS in Alaska?
Yes.
Form of.
No, not really. It doesn't have any sort of planning function. It's a state scientific meeting in the same way that the national AAAS is. Mm-hmm. But
there is today. Dr. Hayden mentioned it, I'd like to underscore it. There is today a suspicion amongst the politicians that the scientists are pretty much troublemakers. And perhaps there's some justice in that view, but it does mean that when you set up something and you say it's a scientific kind of thing, then it has a quality about it which tends to be a little bit threatening or at least annoying to people in politics, because this is now a group that's likely to raise issues that people don't always want to have raised.
Yeah. You and I are broadening our concept of the word science.
Oh, very much.
The general public
very
perhaps
much.
Isn't.
Very
and,
much.
But
there's also a sense of overall logical thinking and applying all existing knowledge to a problem.
And being willing to answer questions even if they're not the ones you wanted raised.
And I'm becoming more and more impressed that you have to go out beyond the bounds of just the logical, rational thought process and take account of people's subjective and emotional responses. to the solutions to
like
problems
that,
that affect the quality
nothing
of
like
your
trying
life.
To sell your program to the Congress to teach you how.
Dr. Lafferty's been trying to get in here. So.
Not necessarily. I do say, though, that communications, really, without technically how you do it, is one of our extreme problems here in the state. That prior to coming to this job, I worked in the Fairbanks North Tarboro School District down here as superintendent of schools, which covers a big center of the state, and served on a number of committees for the governor and others, state commissioner of education, in relationship to problems in developing education. Here we have, under our direction, extension programs and have contracts to do things about civil defense throughout the state, or to touch every one of these small communities to get people in upward bound programs or talent search. And your problem is to really find out about that community, to somehow, I've got to hire guys to travel every one of these little communities to sit down and talk with the chief and some parents and the teachers out there, and on and on. I could give example after example. The cost of getting somebody out into these communities, but you charter a plane here and you charter another one off over here and you finally get and maintain them in that community and all this sort of thing, when all you're trying to do is just to communicate. I mean, you're just trying to find out, which in other places, maybe you could just pick up a telephone, or you could do something.
You're underscoring the remarks I made earlier that that in Alaska, if you have decent communications, you save on the investment in people, energy, in transportation, in materials.
Well, on the economic study, when we just have a demonstration, we all recognize this, just going into it, but when these astronauts, quarter of a million miles away, somebody explains to them, or several million miles away, explains to them how to make changes or adjustment without anybody actually going there. There are all kinds of things we can do if we can set up adequate systems of communication. And here in Alaska, this, I don't care whether we're talking about our marine programs that we have with our fisheries extension and things that we're talking about of just communicating within a program we're working at helping them set up at St. Mary's, a fisheries cooperative. But there's also the problems of communication within that area, within people that are actually gathering the fish and bringing it runs on not only what we do from here, but it's an endless kind of thing that you're constantly frustrated. And I can just pick up program after program simply because you can't communicate. Your basic problem,
right,
how you guys do it, I mean, is a technical problem, what you do. But the problem is real here. You can't communicate over in the valley 10 miles away or on and on. You can just,
This gets to the point that she was raising in which we didn't really respond to. If we take any one of these needs, such as educational, we find that it looks like a tremendous bill. But if you put all these things together, there is the hope that a single system will serve, and you'll have enough cost sharing amongst these uses that what looks like a subsidy, because in a certain sense it's all subsidized, where you're talking about health and education, sure, and supportive activity. When you put it all together, it may be that each package broken out isn't that bad. It may not be any worse than the ratio of ham and eggs in Alaska to ham and eggs in Spokane.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to suggest that you cut out that piece of tape and send it to the office of the governor and see if perhaps the priorities on the communications problems in the state can be readjusted or raised. But of course, cut out my remarks.
Might provide a lot of communications.
Well, when we set up instructional television,
that's only 120 miles long.
You know, down here in this district, when we set up a instructional television to feed out into our little remote schools, this one district down here is as large as the state of New Jersey, and feeding out in these little one room and two, three room schools with that instructional television, which we set up the first program in the state through a commercial broadcast. But we suddenly changed a whole approach that we could make into education, into those down in the Adler School, out into the Moose Creek, over into Two Rivers, so on. We could bring the kinds of things which were being provided, we could provide by circulating instructors and one thing or another, specialists within the town school, but it's real difficult to run a whole slew of those people out there. I mean, there's much, but still the system has to exist in which you can overlay the educational program to the business or whatever you want to.
I've received word that the plane is going to leave on time, so Dean Kime, this may be the last...
Just one comment. I think that we all recognize that there's a tremendous number of problems. And I think we all recognize that we have conducted studies over a period of time. I can remember at least four in 17 years here. I think we've made progress as a consequence of each study. But I think that what needs to be done right now is to get a sort of a definitive, like a definitive study of what our basic problems are, pulling in what's been picked up here, 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 and here. We've got to get down to the basic problems. We've got to get down, it seems to me, to a priority system of how we solve these problems. I think Mr. Merritt has pointed out a very good point. We've got to know how we can communicate the system, what are the bugs in it. So I think more basic than that is, we can't look on the state as one nice, easy test tube experiment, because the state is so varied in terms of people and the geographical locations of these people. And there are so many ramifications to this, I can take all day, but I won't. I think that we have to decide then how there can be an economy through an interdisciplinary effort here. I think that we have to decide what these priorities will be. We have to find out what is presently being done. That's part of the mix. And I have a feeling, without really knowing too much of what I'm talking about, because I don't know, that some of the things that are being done, both for reasons of political expediency or just plain politics, are way out of phase with what our basic needs are and how we ought to go about solving. And I think we kind of need a 1-2-3 order of basic needs, and we need a 1-2-3 order of how we go about solving these things. Unless we do that, it's just going to be another great big boondoggle, and I don't want to have anything to do with it.
May I suggest, sir, that after we leave, Dr. Lafferty will tell you what we have spent the hour discussing. And we think we are offering to you a vehicle or a tool to do just what you said. You have defined the seminar we wish to conduct here in mid-July. We have asked for the support of your facility. We have asked for the support of your professors that are interested, of your graduate students. And it looks like it's going to be a very feasible approach.
I'd like, though, to just differ with you in one respect.
Yes. Well, go ahead.
You're talking, you should be thinking of an ongoing process. This is a growing, developing state. You have a sequence of studies and programs that will be initiated and that will die stretching ahead of you as far as we can see this state going.
65% more people passed and it took this last month than they did last year. And we know that the changes, that Alaska has always been subject to rushes, but this time this rush is going to stick. And the changes that are taking place now are just as rapid as the transition from
winter
to summer.
Well, that means that you...
There is profound.
That means that the thought that we made a study once, why are we making another study again?
No, we've made many studies.
You were going to make many. The process, what you want to do is to institutionalize the process of making these studies, because that's the way life is going to be.
No question.
Well, as I heard you speak, I received a thought. It was a concern that this was another one of those.
And that changes that.
Okay.
Thank you for your presence with us, sir.
Yes, it's nice to have a chance to meet with you.
Great pleasure.
Nice to talk to you.